I'm Michelle Olivier, and you're listening to Hey, I Want Your Job, the podcast that looks at amazing jobs and what it takes to get them. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Hey, I Want Your Job. Today, I'm joined by somebody whose job you could not pay me enough to do, nor would you want to try, because I would be terrible at it. Mark Swarbrick, what is your job?
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
What's your job?
My job, I am head of infrastructure and DevOps for a little fintech startup called Bink.
Okay. That head of infrastructure and DevOps does not sound like that doesn't paint a really clear picture. So what do you do?
So, you know, like the other day where Facebook dropped off the earth and it would have been someone's fault.
That's you like, did that?
I would love to have done that. Unfortunately, it wasn't me, but the kind of responsibility for what they call site reliability engineering, I keeping the platform up, keeping the infrastructure up and keeping the service up is kind of down to me, unfortunately.
Okay. I assume that you're good at this or you wouldn't have continued to be employed in the position you are. So how do you know when somebody is good at what you do?
That's a really good question. I think it's very hard when you're interviewing people, and I've begun to learn this having progressed in my career and starting to interview people as DevOps and infrastructure engineers. It's very hard to tell if somebody's good at what they do. I think it's a mix of technical skills and some soft skills in terms of problem solving and being able to just rationalize and deal with sort of situations under pressure. It's something that's quite hard to quantify sometimes.
I think that's an astute thing to say, because one of the things that I hear with my clients a lot is, oh, we need a dev person, so we'll just give them a Java test or a Python or whatever the language is. And I'm like, being able to code in Java, like, there are other factors to consider. So talk to me a little bit about what are those factors, right? That it's not just like speed of Java, it's not fluency in Java, there's more to it than that. What makes somebody, what separates the good dev from the bad dev?
I think the good dev from the bad dev, and it's going to sound a bit cliched, but it's communication skills and interpersonal skills, because for me, any job is about people talking to other people. And even in what you think is a traditionally sort of insular environment where you just, it's a developer and a computer, and you pick up these ideas of someone literally in a dark room just coding away. And that there is elements of that when you get down to it, but especially in sort of modern agile environments, especially where you're working remotely, you need to be able to communicate. You need to be able to articulate a way of doing something. You need to, you know, especially when they're working in a scrum together or something like that, and you've got many coders working on the same sort of piece of code together, the ability to stick to coding standards, to communicate, to articulate feelings about an approach to doing something, I think is really important on top of just the raw ability to be able to code themselves.
So I think that's really interesting. So I was talking to another guest a while back who he and I agreed on something that is juxtaposed exactly to what you just said, which is that our experience is that often the people who create the most elegant and sort of best quality initial code are neurodivergents, and that
absolutely,
they absolutely struggle to no end often with communication, that the verbal communication in particular for them is like when you're in a stand up, you know, and when you're in the scrum and they're like, who has an idea?
And no one will speak.
Yeah, like they're just gonna
absolutely
crickets. And so, but they are, and again, as you know, I know nothing about what code actually is, but I do know that there is elegant code and then there is other code. That it is the neuroatypicals who generally do the highest quality, most elegant code the first time with the fewest bugs.
Absolutely. And it's a beautiful thing to witness. And it's interesting that when I say communication skills and everything like that, I'd say a very high proportion of even my DevOps team, as well as the development team itself, is definitely neurodivergent. And I've tried various different methods to get people's voice heard. And I would say they are good at communication, but not in a typical way. So we have something called, where we are at the moment, TDGs, technical discussion groups or technical decision groups, where the idea was to get everyone on a call to discuss an approach to doing something. And all that happened is you had the people that were more confident and outspoken and happy to give their points of view, be able to articulate their points of view, and they weren't necessarily the people that we should be listening to. So what I tried to initiate was a way of people being able to just silently just give their view on a coding approach. And I even took it further than that and do it anonymously, so people didn't feel they had to put their names up against it. And it's almost like an ideas box before the meeting. And then people that didn't want to speak during that meeting could submit their ideas and their different approaches. It's very interesting. What was that? Sorry?
Did it work?
It did. Absolutely, it did. And we actually ended up sort of our quality of code is improving and our level of contribution improved because people felt they could contribute in a way that they felt comfortable doing. And when interviewing somebody, I'd certainly, you know, if they're quiet, shy, and I don't feel that they're gregarious, that for me doesn't necessarily mean that their communication skills aren't great as a whole. It just means that I need to try and get out of them how they wish to communicate. And what I normally find is I'd say, like, okay, talk to me about a particular bit of code you wrote or something that you're really proud of, not necessarily how would you deal with a meeting with such and such. And in that instance, you get them talking about something that they're passionate and interested about, and that I generally tend to find they lose themselves a little bit and talk about the passion for it. So if I can get the passion for what they do out of them, that means that they can articulate and communicate that. Then I think it's up to the business and me as their manager to be able to create a forum that they feel they can contribute, that they're actually confident in doing.
So that's really interesting. And I think that there's this ongoing debate broadly around neurodivergence and interviews and whether or not it is a good idea or appropriate, either one, to disclose when you are neurodivergent at the outset. And here's the argument, right? So many interviewers judge based on they didn't smile, they didn't make eye contact, they didn't seem enthusiastic. And it may be that that's because they are neuroatypical and those things are not things that they can do.
Absolutely.
And so there's an argument out there that is, if you begin the conversation by saying, I'm so excited to meet you today. I just want to let you know I am neurodivergent. And so things like smiling and eye contact are really hard for me, but please don't take that to mean that I'm not excited to be here. How do you feel about that as a piece of advice?
As a piece of advice, I think, judging from the people I've interviewed, I think it could go one of two ways. I think it could either put people at ease and they think, okay, that's great. I've spoken to and coached a couple of people on my team that were completely unaware of that they might be neurodivergent or on the spectrum or struggle with different things until I actually approached them and said, you realize you find this quite difficult, or why do you find this quite difficult in that scenario, and coach them through it. I'm not sure, certainly from the people I've interviewed, that everyone is that self-aware.
No. But if you know you are, right, if going into it, you know that that's a thing about you, do you feel like, I genuinely struggle with this, because on the one hand, I feel like if you know that about you, right, if they're going to discriminate against you, they're going to do that anyway.
Absolutely. And
so you might as well know the interview.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think if I was a hiring manager and I was interviewing somebody and I judged a developer that because he couldn't give me eye contact or struggled to communicate or anything else, I would say it's not a good company, or I wouldn't be a good hiring manager to manage them anyway, because you've got to know your audience, right? So when we're interviewing for developers, a lot of it, you know, we There's obviously we have sort of a technical competency that we ask them to go through, you know, write an example bit of code, but then we've also got some questions around that sort of, you know, tell me about a bit of code that you're particularly proud of, or just questions which, like, you know, how did you work or how did you collaborate on a bit of code with somebody? Those kind of questions, and those are the questions I'd ask. And, you know, I've even had some people where, you know, that they've asked me, do we have to have the camera on? You know, and I've said, absolutely not. No, if it doesn't make you feel comfortable. And again, I haven't been proactive in asking, are you happy with the camera on, you know, and had that preamble up front. But I have had a couple of people say to me, look, can we do it just over the phone? Or, you know, do we have to have the video on? Or can I see the questions beforehand? You know, and I think there's a lot more, allowances is probably the wrong word, but I think accommodation and understanding and empathy of the kind of personality types that make a good developer, which obviously if I was recruiting for a salesperson or a pre-sales engineer, wouldn't fly.
Sure. And I think, so I find it really interesting. One of the things that I coach my clients on is that sometimes even in this space, even hiring managers who are trying to be inclusive and sensitive, et cetera, ask questions that make sense to them, forgetting that neuroatypical folks tend to be extremely literal. So yeah. If you say, what would you do in X situation, right? Then they are going to, like, how would you do this? They're going to answer that exactly literally. They're not going to say, I would ask these five questions and clarify this scenario, because that's not what you ask them. What you ask them is, how would you do this thing? And so I think that, I do think that there is some training and work that needs to be out there for managers, even with the best of intentioned ones like yourself.
I totally agree, because even my personal awareness of, you know, just the way the human brain works and the kind of personality types, I think it was almost sort of derogatory, detrimental humor, I think, when earlier in my career, you know, almost laughing at the devs, what a bunch of weirdos they are, et cetera, et cetera. And despite me being one, so it was, you know, you laughed at the more extreme. And I think it's only as you sort of grow up and mature, and I think there's a general better understanding of neurodivergence, and especially some of the benefits that actually hiring neurodivergent people can bring, and also some of the challenges that you have of getting the best out of them and integrating with the rest of the company. I think more training would be useful, and certainly how to ask a question. I think your example of giving hypotheticals is like almost the worst thing you can do. Yet for me, I'll go, right, let's picture a scenario. Let's imagine something in my head. Hypothetically.
Walk with me on this journey.
Yeah. And I've had people tell me, well, that wouldn't happen. And I'm like, and suddenly you're like, oh yeah. I generally tend to find that if I'm being too wayward, they reset me because they can't help it but reset me a lot of the time.
It depends on how they fall. But I really like your point about, like, when you were younger, you were douchier. I do think that, like, for basically good humans, a huge part of growing up is realizing what a complete and total douchebag you were in your youth. I know that that's true for me. Like, I look back on things I've said, things I've done, and I'm like, oi, Olivier, what the hell were you thinking there?
Absolutely. And I always like to use the excuse of, you know, society was a bit different back then as well. But no,
argument. And you, my friend, are not a grandpa.
Not yet. I think, Even with sort of COVID and the lockdown, and for me, the ability to have more flexible work, it's been really interesting how actually looking at work patterns, even for, you know, non-neurodivergent people, actually being more flexible about how we work, the work day, whether they're in the office or not, has actually helped the recruitment process for us a hell of a lot, because the stuff that I was banging on about, I think people have got, and we've got a much more flexible environment that I think suits a lot more of our neurodivergent workforce.
I think that's kind of true across the board. I know that in the US, which is a slightly different market, right now we're really seeing a lot of people who won't go back to the office Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. They're just like, nope, screw you, not gonna happen. As it turns out, I like my home. I like my partner. I like my kids. I like my hobbies. Not interested. And really, like, what? I feel like there's so many businesses out there that are like, we're going to go back to the office as soon as possible. Because why? Because you, Mr. Business Owner, have worked that way. So I love to hear that, you know, you guys are celebrating that and embracing those changes. One of the things that managers have struggled with throughout lockdown in particular is creating some kind of a corporate culture, creating some kind of harmonious existence between your teammates when you can't just shove them in the same room and feed them pizza. What do you do? How do you make that work with your team?
So with our team, we've tried to sort of see what we could bring them together. So the whole virtual quiz thing, it's a bit of a cliche, but actually they've enjoyed quite a lot of that. So we've had third-party companies to come in and do quiz nights and quiz sessions. And, you know, people get to choose their teams and mix it up a bit. And people enjoy that.
Have you done
the
virtual escape rooms? Because those sound cool as hell.
No, we haven't done virtual escape rooms yet.
Find the times, Mark. Come on now.
I know. So I think the other thing we've done is virtual game nights. A lot of our developers are big gamers. So we've actually set up like virtual game nights where one or two people have offered to host some games and we'll play against each other. It's really good. The other thing we've done is virtual hackathons. So where there's areas which you want to address in the business, as well as just some fun stuff, we said, look, take Friday, join up some, you know, on, you know, whether it's Teams or some collaborative working, and literally just come together, forget about everything else, turn your Teams off and go and build something, and then go and show us at the end of the week or the end of the day what you've done, allowing them to just have complete freedom and just put your heads together and go and do something. I think they've really appreciated doing. And also encouraging people back to the office when they want to. And what we've found is that actually they like the office when it's quiet as well. And because there's not so many people in there, we've created some soft spaces, like soft areas, like beanbags and sort of like pod working areas. And they've actually, some people have voluntarily wanted to come in and work on some projects together because they want to, not because we've said they had to. And just allowing that flexibility has been really good.
Awesome. And I think that all of that, I think that tech lends itself to that a little bit more than other industries, because you Massively. Do, like, in general, like, people are comfortable on technology. They do tend to be gamers, right? Like, there are technology options for them that they will find in engaging, whereas some other industries, people are like, the last freaking thing I want to do is go home and log into another computer with you. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right? And absolutely. And I think the fact that they're fairly technology native and they embrace new technology has actually helped the whole working from home thing as well. And yeah, the fact that they are technically savvy and happy to hop on a computer and do collaborative stuff together, like even just like proper sort of casual gaming stuff, like a game of Among Us, you know, and stuff like that, it's been really good fun, and that they've enjoyed that and welcomed that.
Cool. So we talked about neurodivergence. We talked about keeping your team happy and feeling the love in COVID. And I don't know if you're aware, spoiler, you're a white dude. I know. What were the ads? I hope that doesn't shatter any like personal like beliefs you have, but there you go. And in technology, in senior leadership, you may have heard that that's pretty normal.
Mm. Yes.
So as much as you're doing a lot to try to embrace more sort of neurodivergency, that sort of thing, let's talk about women. We've talked about like that there's a real like quantifiable value add from having neurodivergence on your team. Do you feel the same way about women? What is your experience of women in technology?
I would say obviously they're the minority, you know, big shocker there, but the ones I have worked with, I've universally been impressed with. So I worked with a really strong female tech DevOps engineer a few years ago, who was absolutely fantastic, held her own, and was fantastically technical. And her sex wasn't really an issue because she held her own technically, and it just worked. It worked really well. I would have and I can genuinely say there's no prejudice in hiring a woman from a technical standpoint or any other fitting in. I would say, if anything, it's if I came across more good candidates or any candidates in a lot of respects, I would have no issue hiring. We've got some female devs. They've been very successful where I am at the moment. Female DevOps engineers seem to be an even rarer thing. I'd say I've interviewed for 5 or 6 roles, I think, and I haven't had a single female applicant at all for any of them.
So I'm going to challenge you on that.
Yeah.
Say that I know personally a fantastic recruiter in the UK who only works with minority candidates. So she works with women and minorities in those fields, and she very successfully, consistently fills DevOps roles with women.
Okay.
So I believe that you absolutely believe all the things you just said to me. So knowing now that empirically the candidates are out there, where do you think the disconnect comes? Where do you
if the candidates are out there, the recruiters that we're using aren't presenting those candidates. I haven't seen a single female candidate that I've even scanned and rejected. I've not been presented with a single female candidate.
Okay. Okay. And are these in-house recruiters or agencies?
No, these are agency. We have 4 different agencies that we've successfully placed. They've placed good candidates, and not a single female DevOps candidate has ever come across my desk.
So we will talk offline about perhaps this agency to consider.
So this agency that you mentioned, she exclusively deals with minority mm-hmm. candidates. Do you think that's a problem in itself? If that agency isn't on our preferred vendor list, and it is quite hard to get on, you know what it's like as a recruiter, you get a company, they've got their recruiters that they like. That almost means that the minorities might end up going to this one recruiter, which is then not on my preferred vendor list for recruiters. Therefore, they've almost been hived off to someone I'm never going to see.
So I guess I would turn that back on you and say that there are a number of recruitment agencies out there that specialize in diversity hiring. And so surely the issue is not the fact that there are those recruiters, but that you don't have diversity recruitment agencies on your PSL.
I guess I never really would really think that I have to actively seek out recruiters that are looking for candidates in that way. Perhaps that's a naive thought, but I've certainly had a lot of candidates from many different ethnic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. A lot that, you know, aren't native to this country. English isn't their first language. So I never came across an ethnicity issue, but certainly in terms of sex I have. So I wouldn't have put the two together, because if I see our recruiters coming across all different kinds of candidates from all different ethnicities and different backgrounds, but just not women, then I wouldn't necessarily have put the two together that I need a specialist recruiter just to get me female candidates.
So let me paint it from the other perspective for you and see if that helps. Oh, as a woman personally who deals with technology all the time, it is not always pleasant. It is a male-dominated field. I get talked over. I get ignored. I get called honey. I get marginalized. I feel like you know me well enough to know about how far I take that.
Absolutely.
But that is me. And not every person out there has, you know, 0 fucks to give about what people say about that, right? Not everybody has it in them to turn around and be like, look, so, you know, I had have a recruiter that I work with who is fantastic. She's new to being in recruitment. She's in technology, and she has been working with a hiring manager that just talks over her and says stuff that is, from a recruiter's perspective, profoundly stupid. Like, why aren't you looking for people on monster.com? And she's like, because they filed for bankruptcy and nobody is there except scammers. Mm-hmm. What? Right. But this hiring manager just ignores her and consistently talks over her, and he knows how to do her job better than she ever will. And she said to me, how would you handle that? And I was like, well, that may not be a helpful answer to you. Because I would say, look, boyo, I don't tell you how to code. How about you don't tell me how to recruit? I've been doing this for over 20 years. When you can say the same, we'll trade seats.
Absolutely.
Until then, I'm going to do my job and you go do yours. But not everybody can say that, right? Like, that's a very specific skin to live in. But that is the norm. And so we have, like, the complaints that have come out against Apple, against Blizzard, you know, companies that have always been heralded as inclusive and welcoming. And then we find out that just how bad it was, especially for women in those organizations. And so as a result, what that does is, if you are a woman in technology, why would you throw the dice? Why would you go somewhere that may or may not be friendly to women in technology when there is instead an option to work with a recruiter who only works with people who are excited about women in technology, who have good policies of diversity balancing, who have an inclusive environment, and where it's a safer bet in terms of a literally safe environment for you to be in.
And when you say a safe environment, you mean as in the recruitment agency is a safe environment?
As in the people, though. So organizations that hire diversity recruitment agencies who are going out of their way to work with organizations specifically for that. I don't know any diversity agencies that will work with a company that does not have good practice in place around inclusive practice, around harassment reporting, safe environment, those types of things.
Yeah.
And so as a female or as a, you know, an underrepresented group, by working as a candidate with a diversity recruitment agency, wherever you get, you have higher odds of being in a safe and inclusive environment than anywhere that isn't working with those. So why would you, that's a way better choice for them. And there's enough people actively seeking those candidates that, as you know, right, as a hiring manager yourself, like, candidates are flying off the shelves. Like, it's a hot market right now.
Oh, absolutely. But I think what that's doing is creating a sort of a tiered, the companies that care will end up with more good female candidates. And I might care, but 100% of the recruiters that I deal with are female recruiters. It happens to be. So they're all on, you know, all on our preferred list. I've tried to get different recruitment agencies in at times, very difficult process to get through that. So I think there's an appetite, absolutely there's an appetite for me to hire female candidates, and there's no prejudice on my side. But it's almost that unless the company as a whole drives this initiative from HR, you know, the VP level, and drives that, I'm almost denied that opportunity to find a lot of female candidates because they've gone with diversity candidates, which recruitment agencies, which I wasn't even aware there's a thing.
You didn't even know there's a thing until today.
Yeah, yeah. So perhaps I'm being starved of female candidates because they're going to companies that might be more aware of that as a
Have you drive. Said to your recruiters, why do I not have female candidates?
I have.
What do they say?
And that they have said they're just isn't that they aren't there. Which is really interesting. So
that is, yeah.
And for me, I was quite cynical about recruiters because, you know, there's good recruiters and bad recruiters, right?
Most of them are bad.
And for me, I would think, well, why would you discriminate against the sex when all you really care about is placing a candidate and getting your commission? So
here's why. And I can answer that as a recruiter who is not a douchebag recruiter. I have worked with a lot of hiring managers over the years. And this is one of those, when hiring managers talk about being experts in recruitment, I know that you feel like you are because you do so much of it, and it's such an important part of building your team and your job. But there's a really big difference in you only deal with you as a hiring manager, whereas as a recruiter, I've dealt with thousands of you, right? So I have all of the different flavors and experience of what hiring managers look like, how they approach hiring, what they want, etc. And from that perspective, I will tell you, I have literally had hiring managers tell me, I don't want women in this team. I have literally had them tell me, I already have one woman on the team is fine, two women gets bitchy. That's a common one. I have had them say all sorts of things about those candidates and not wanting to have them. So same, I have had the same comments about people from all kinds of ethnic backgrounds, people from neurodivergent backgrounds,
yeah,
people from different sexualities or gender presentations, people from different ages. That's a big one. Like, I'm looking for somebody kind of between 25 and 32. No, not for me or not. Sorry. But again, I am the person who turns around and says, hey, what you just said, totally illegal. We're going to pretend you didn't say it, and I'm still going to send you good candidates this time. And if you say it again, I'm just not going to work with you. That's me, right? Not everybody is A, going to say that, and B, there's some privilege that goes with that, because I can say that. And if they say, well, then screw you, I'll go find another agency that will, like, jog on, douchebag. And like, I'm happy to do that. Not everybody can, right? If you work for an agency and you have clients who are walking because you're holding them to a standard they don't want to be held to, you may lose your job. I work for myself. I can't get fired.
So is your point then that, you know, the age, well, I won't say the agencies I deal with, but the agencies that I have dealt with, say, agencies in general, they are more likely to go for a more generally accepted demographic because it's easier to place them. Is that the point?
That's you're exactly on? Right.
Okay, fine.
So they are in a competitive environment, right? So when you work with contingency recruiters at all, and this is why I think that contingency recruitment is one of the many banes of evil in the system. When you, as a hiring manager, work with a contingency recruiter, it's an innately adversarial relationship between you, right? Because they want you to hire only their person for the most amount of money they can possibly get out of you. And the poor candidates get commoditized. They're just the hamburgers that they're trying to sell you.
Oh, completely, yeah.
Right? So if candidate C is less expensive than candidate A, even if they would be a better fit, they're going to tell you all the reasons not to hire candidate C, or maybe not even put them forward, because it's better business for them to present you candidate A that costs more. And you can't necessarily trust the feedback they give you, right? They say, oh, yeah, like you're paying way below market. Like market is definitely, you know, 30K over where you are. You're like, that you're just trying to get a higher fee. Like, and that they may be telling you the truth. They may not, but you don't know, because you've set yourself up in this position where manipulating you is how they make their money, as opposed to working with you being how they make their money.
And this is where I'm slightly disappointed then, because the majority of the recruiters that I've liked working with, I like building a relationship with, you know, and again, I'm not sure the correct terminology, but basically ones that want to establish a working relationship with us, not just place a crappy candidate and hope they last longer than 3 months. You know, these are people that want to work with us, that want to understand our business, want to understand what's going on. Now, I have been very open with them because, you know, I've had the questions asked, you know, what sort of candidates are you looking for? And I said, I honestly don't care as long as they can do the job. So I haven't outwardly, and certainly in terms of the company, given any bias or any indication to bias of gender, sexuality, racial background, anything else. And these are recruitment agencies that, you know, I've worked with for a few years. But then if what you're saying is that they still, the recruitment agencies are not actively targeting or working for women to try and place them because they think there's a bigger prejudice against them, then
it's easier to find men. So they only get paid for what you hire.
Yes.
So there is no incentive for them. If they've already found you three candidates that you're interested in interviewing, they have zero incentive to continue to find you candidates.
So, I mean,
if men are at the top of the pile and the first ones to reply because there's more of them, they have zero incentive to keep digging until they find a female.
Which is disappointing, because for me, if I had females, female candidates' CVs put in front of me, I would be looking and reviewing them. So for me, it feels almost like it feels more of a problem with recruitment almost, because there could be an unconscious bias, or a conscious bias for them that actually, if they did get more females, they would place more females. If they push females more, then I'd get more places.
I don't want to demonize your recruiters. I'm sure they're very nice women.
Yeah.
My guess is that really it's more the way that they make their money is with the placement. So they need to minimize the amount of effort that they put into any given placement, because only a certain percentage of those are going to pay off, right? So if you have five agencies that you're working with, they're in direct competition with all those other agencies for any given role, plus a direct hire. And so they need to minimize the amount that they invest in any given opportunity working for you or anybody else.
Yeah.
And so if they do a search and have contact 50 candidates, right? They do a search and 100 candidates turn up on the search. They contact the top 50. The first four people that reply that look good, they're going to send those over, and then they're done. They peace out because they have to from a business model. So in an environment that is overwhelmingly male, statistically, your odds of those first four people always being male are extremely high.
Yeah, makes sense. I just think it's a shame that it's ended up being that way around, because what really, if I want any chance of placing or having a decent female candidate as an employee, as a company, I've got to then go and actively seek that through an agency, rather than the agencies actually managing to, get me female candidates. It's an interesting way around to look at it.
And I think that probably both sides would argue that it's the other's fault, right? That the agencies are catering to what is the prevailing taste in the market, and then hiring managers would say that I can only hire what I get presented with. So
it's an interesting one, and I guess it's also what the driver is. So for me, I've with the agencies that I've got, with the candidates that have been presented to me, I've managed to hire some really excellent talent. Unfortunately, it's not very divergent talent. So, when it comes to whether it's male or female. So it's, for me, being absolutely candid with you, there's got to be enough pain or drive with me to want to actively challenge HR, challenge my business internally, fight to get a recruiter on board, and then try and hire someone and then pitch against the other recruiters, rather than, to actually seek out and do that. And the problem is, I haven't had enough pain recruiting to actually for that to be worth doing.
And I get that, right? And that's the thing, is that, like I think you said earlier, the whole organization has to be invested in being better.
Yeah.
And if they're not, it's really hard. Now, what I would say is I have seen some hiring managers who have said, I don't want to look at anybody until you present me with at least one female. So you can incentivize your recruiters, right? Like, I'm going to tell you right now, if you get me a female recruit an interview, if you get me a female CV that ticks the boxes, I will guarantee them an interview. Now you have incentivized the hell out of your agencies to go and find a female, right? Because now that's good business all of a sudden. Digging to find that female candidate now means that they are guaranteed an interview. Well, an interview is a really good first step. I can tell you, recruitment is all about numbers. So if you get a certain percentage of people you get to interview, wind up getting the job. So you have cut out a huge thing if you are guaranteeing them an interview. So there are some things you can do as a hiring manager that are workarounds. I have one hiring manager that I get to work with, and he is one of my favorites. And one of the things that we were hiring for a Java developer forum, and my sourcer said to him, so like online, where do Java developers hang out? Like, where should we look for them? And he paused and he said, I'm going to decline to answer that question, because I know where Java developers that look like me hangout. I don't want a Java developer that looks like me. And it was like, well, frickin' noted.
Yeah.
And it was just very, like, it made it very clear that one of his priorities in hiring was diverse candidates, and that's what he gets, is yeah. diverse candidates. So you can have those conversations, and if they are the great recruiters that you feel like they are, and I hope that they are, they will honor that and listen to you. And even if they're just money-hungry fools, they'll listen to the cha-ching.
They'll listen to what the demand is. Yeah.
Right.
And I guess I've never gone further than saying, look, I want a good quality. I want a small number of well-selected, well-qualified candidates where you've understood the job spec. I've never ever gone further than saying, I would like a female candidate, or I want to make sure there's a good mix of ethnic diversity in, because I guess as far as I'm concerned, I just wanted someone that can do the job, that's good at doing the job. I almost didn't want to almost positively discriminate because I didn't see the massive added value. It's a nice to have rather than a I must have. So mm-hmm. perhaps that's where, you know, attitudes could shift slightly.
I think that is very good self-awareness, and I shall let you off the hook for further on that. But I hopefully this has helped.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, if I could have this conversation one hiring manager at a time, I feel like we could move a lot of needles on that. So let's leave diversity for a minute and talk about other things in your space. You fintech in the UK in particular is having a moment of yes. challenge.
Yes.
Talk to me about the specifics that have, some of the specific political issues in particular that have yeah. helped you create your moment of challenge.
Yeah, no, there's a lot going on. I think for us, it's a real juxtaposition between what we're trying to do in fintech and the fact that we're fintech in retail. Mm-hmm. So you've got all the market forces and politics going on, you know, with the economy and what's happening there. But then you've also got how bricks and mortar retail has been decimated as well. So it's a real challenge at the moment to actually to get the traction we need to get the confidence and to be able to build up what we're doing at the moment. So yeah, it's really quite challenging.
And what about very specifically, like, I know that there's been a lot of ramifications for the banking and finance industry in the UK and Europe as a whole because of Brexit. How has that hit you guys one way or the other?
So yeah. Brexit's been a very interesting one. The fact that we're not trading outside the UK, that we're dealing with UK banks and we're dealing with UK retailers, it's only sort of the second party. It's only the second hand sort of what's happened to the economy that's affected us. But in terms of actual trading and who we're dealing with, we're only really dealing with the UK. So it hasn't affected us directly. However, the knock-on effects for just supply chain logistics has been massive. Labor shortage, you know, for logistics as well. And because that's hit retailers, then that's then hit us as well in terms of how confident they are, you know, the general level of market confidence and the stability of the country as a whole.
So has it affected your expansion plans? Because obviously, you know, you're a startup, so you want to take over the world. And England is a small island in the North Sea. Like,
so very, very much so.
EU, US expansion is different.
Yeah, so the US is a very different market, as you know, and especially when it comes to retail, it's a completely different language. Even in terms of your payment processing, cards, banks, the concept of checking accounts, and you know, even the way you pay is just, you know, completely alien. So that was always going to be a challenge.
We are aliens. True.
Yeah, that's and that was always a challenge. And actually, because we're used to that, and you know, the fact that you're outside the EU, it's definitely been the challenge dealing with EU countries. One of the expansion plans was over to Australia, which was interesting, and that's been slowed down actually significantly by the Australian government data protection laws and how much the government actually wants to see of the data and how transparent it's got to be, which has actually made working with Australian banks a lot more difficult. Unfortunately, I'm probably not the best person to speak to in terms of how Brexit has affected us, because there was no European expansion plans as yet. And the thing is, if there was, even without Brexit, even inside the EU, each country has got their own banking laws, data protection laws. And I think this view that sort of being inside the EU harmonized everything and everything just works symbiotically, I think was a bit of a misnomer in a lot of ways. Yes, some legislation would have been harmonized, which would have made the legal work a little bit easier, but each country has got its own quirks, and especially when it comes to sort of like data compliance, PCI compliance, data protection, you know, there was a lot of differences between the countries anyway. So for us, it didn't make a huge difference.
Okay. But Australia is a pain, and America, we're just aliens, so you're not coming.
We are. You know what it is? It's the barrier to entry. There's definitely plans, and we'd like to go over there, but it's like anything, you need to establish a decent sales presence, you know, for what you're trying to do. It's a completely different world. You need people in country. And I think, if anything, to your original question, what Brexit has done is it slowed down our expansion plans greatly, because the whole market has slowed. So obviously, at the moment, we're in a pre-revenue startup, so it's the time it takes to establish yourself in one country before you can expand. So I think the aspirations of quicker expansion have definitely been slowed down by not just Brexit, but also COVID as well. It's been a double whammy of things over the last couple of years.
That sucks. I'm sorry. Really sorry that it sucks, that it makes it hard for you to expand to the US, but this is really common. I think that people don't necessarily realize how much that's true. So as I think you know, I worked for a long time in the UK for the largest recruitment company in the world, whose name may start with an R and rhyme with bead. But like, they don't exist in the US. And so, which for somebody, especially from the UK, but like from anywhere in Europe, like that's a really weird idea. That like, what do you mean they don't exist? Like there is none. There is nothing from them here. They do not in any way engage with, exist in the American market. So much so that people are like, and who is this company? I was like,
what?
Like, oh, yes.
Do you not know who I am? Who I work for?
It is, yeah, that kind of, like, when I first came over, I'm like, I'm sorry. Say what the what now? Like, yeah. Really asking that? They're like, I had somebody the other day who asked me if I knew the annual turnover for that company, and I was like, no, but a lot.
And that's
privately held, so.
Yeah, and it's an interesting.
I could call the owner, but I don't think he'd take my call, and he definitely.
No, and it's an interesting observation how so many brands don't manage, even big, massive organizations don't manage to make that jump across the pond. And having worked for American companies and based in the UK or in Europe, culturally, I found the jump, even going to work for an American company, the atmosphere, the offices were so regionalized. You know, you'd go over to different countries. Like, I spent some time in the West Coast. I spent some time, you know, in Denver, you know, East Coast as well. And just corporate culture and, you know, the markets they were dealing with, you know, it was a different world. We joke how it was alien. It's almost everything is different. And to make that jump, and I imagine you found similarities and differences for recruitment massively as well, and how you've had to act between.
I mean, so American market does not rely on agencies like the UK does. It is the exception that companies use agencies to recruit, as opposed to the UK market, where it is the exception to try not to. If you don't have a bevy of agencies that you're working with, the question is really, oh, that's so cute. How small are you exactly?
Yeah. absolutely.
Like, that's how everybody hires. So yeah, it's very culturally different in that regard. But I do think it's interesting that, like, you guys have been like, oh, there be dragons. Maybe well, not. Because Tesco tried and Tesco failed. Like, and that's freaking absolutely. Tesco, right?
And what it is, it's the barrier to entry financially. There's so much that's not transferable. You know, in our business, banking, completely different laws, you know, ways of doing consumer behavior. Retail, completely different, completely consumer behavior. So you could have a product offering, but almost no transferable legal documents, no transferable ways of working, no transferable culture. Even when it comes down to employee laws, or everything is alien and different. So to make that jump, there's got to be enough of a commercial security and impetus to be able to do that and to make that jump.
And I also think that, so of course, bring it back to me, because it's always about me. I get people find out, like, oh, you worked in the UK, or I'll say something that has like a weird British accent to it for a second. And they'll be like, oh, you're in the UK for a while. I'd love to work over there. I'm like, would you? Because I feel like you don't know. You know nothing, Jon Snow, right? Like, you went to London one time on vacation with your family and you think now you want to live and work there. British working culture, totally different to American working culture. And like moving over here, I'm like, my husband is English. And so like one of the big deals is the US, we don't have employment contracts. And there's no guaranteed anything. You can walk in tomorrow and they're like, I've decided to hate your face and you're fired. Bye.
It wasn't until actually speaking to your husband and, actually sort of looking, actually saying, well, how have you found it? What's different? What's changed? And I understand a lot of actually the culture and the politics off the back of the working environment, especially when you factor in private healthcare as well. So yeah. I'll give you an example. So I went into the Denver headquarters. It was pretty much after Sun left, the biggest employer, in the city. And I sort of went in, a lot of things were broken, a lot of things weren't right. And I was coming over there to sort of educate and help. I got a load of people in a room and said, right, come on then, let's actually have a candid conversation. Let's talk about what we can fix. Nobody wanted to put their hand up. Nobody wanted to put their head over the parapet. People actually felt awkward being there. And I was just like, it wasn't until I went for beers with a couple of guys. And he's like, this is like the only employer. If I lose my job, I lose my healthcare, I'm not going to have a job and I'm going to have to move my entire family out. It's not worth it to cause any trouble or put my hand up or say anything. And that to me was a massive sort of culture shock. So it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, and I had the same thing the other way in the UK, like, being in a meeting and people will be like, so what do you think about this? And people just straight up saying, like, this is horrible. And I'm like, what is happening right now?
Yeah.
Does nobody have any fear? And the answer is no. And it's very empowering, but like there's swings and roundabouts, right? So like on the upside, you get more candid feedback from your staff in the UK. On the other side, there is the what happens after a year of employment that everybody is familiar with in the UK, right? People feel safe, they feel comfortable, they put their feet.
Oh yeah, I mean that.
You work
your ass off for a year, make everyone think you're wonderful, and go right, okay then, yeah, I'm in, I'm done, absolutely.
Which, I mean, it's not true for the record that you can't be fired in the UK, but it is like it. It's a lot harder.
Well, the fact that I haven't been fired yet, I think is testament to the security of the employment laws over there. So over here, so not too bad.
Well, and I think, so that's another like cultural thing, right? Like when I came to the UK and was looking for jobs and they're like, oh, what happened there? I was like, oh, it didn't work out because such and such. They're like, were you terminated? Yes. And they're like, oh.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, in the States, like almost everybody's been terminated. Is that like... We're cool, especially in Texas, where literally you can be fired for no cause. You were doing a great job. You just walked in one day, your boss had like a hangover and an attitude and told you jog on and like, that's it.
Yeah.
You can't be as much of a hang up as it is here as it is in the UK, because you would never hire anybody if you didn't hire somebody who'd ever been terminated. Now, was I ever terminated for calls? Of course I was. I was exceedingly mouthy in my youth. Of course, now, shy and retiring, wilting flower that I am.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
But yeah. So yeah, I think that's fascinating. And a little disappointing on a personal level that you guys are not rapidly expanding into the US.
No, I'd love it to happen. I had plans, you know, I hear Austin's the place to be. So
I hear that.
No, I was watching quite a good program about sort of the exodus from California to Austin and Texas in general. It's quite interesting to see how the dynamics are playing out there as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And at the same time, there's a whole like movement in Austin, or not in Austin, but in Texas at large, but like Californians go home. It's all, we can talk more offline because it is fascinating to be have a
yeah, no, absolutely.
For that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
So I haven't asked you yet. One of the questions I ask everybody, and we are almost out of time. So
yep.
Mark, how do you respond when people ask you how much you make?
My response is generally favorable or market rate or just above market rates.
Okay.
Or not enough, depending who I'm speaking to.
Okay. I like that, not enough. We often, my husband's response is, I think you know, is usually I do all right, which is not very helpful. Yeah. Okay. And what, because we are almost out of time, what have I not asked you that I should have asked?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think feedback on the recruitment process in general, because for me, I was talking to a friend the other day about how retarded buying processes, for example, you know, how it's still so antiquated and it shouldn't be like that. I kind of feel the same about a lot of the recruitment process. And just how difficult it is, you know, to read a candidate off a CV or to find a good recruiter or, you know, the interview process or anything. And for me, I think a shake-up and education, and I think there's room for a proper disruptor in the market or a movement, if you like, as well, because it feels almost like, I don't know, what's a good analogy? Almost like before there was internet dating and apps and all this other kind of stuff. Like, how do I meet somebody? How do I go out and do this? And there's been so much effort that's been put into people like hooking up, you know, compared to actually finding good candidates for jobs. You know, I would love if there, I'm not suggesting like Tinder for recruitment, but you know, maybe there's some better way of actually matching good candidates to good companies and including that diversity, including support for neurodivergence, you know, and just making it better. It just feels like a frustrating place. So I'd love to know, you know, your thoughts around that.
I would agree. I think that, for reasons I don't understand, we still recruit like it's 1996.
Yeah.
And that just not a lot has changed other than now we do shit on Zoom and that we didn't used to. But okay, other than that, like it's basically same shit, different day, which I find remarkable. I am dubious, but slightly optimistic about the movement that I see on LinkedIn. And the reason I'm a little optimistic about that is because LinkedIn profiles, because, you know, I've been doing this forever. I was on LinkedIn when it was in beta. And it was always like basically like a virtual Rolodex. Again, dating myself with that term. But, you know, but that was what it was, right? It was just like people that you met in work, and you didn't really use it like a social media platform. Now, when I'm on LinkedIn and I'm looking at candidates, and I never see CVs, I only get from my sources, I only get LinkedIn URLs. It's the only thing I see. I look at those, and then that's what my hiring managers look at as well. And the nice thing, and one of the things that my hiring managers are excited about, is that in that space, not only are people providing their professional details, but also some of their personality. So, like, one of, you know, people, I got somebody got an interview the other day because they had on their LinkedIn that they were a cupcake enthusiast, and they're like, I want to interview the cupcake enthusiast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And so having those little drops of personality and some cues about who you are at the outset on like your LinkedIn profile, and having that be something that is increasingly an expectation and something that people want in the hiring process, I think is a really good early stage first step. I, of course, am totally radical and have hugely divergent ideas on what should or shouldn't happen. There's some really cool companies doing cool things that are kind of watch this space. So like Vervo is a great company. I'm not endorsed by them. They did send me a really cute koala bear. But I just think that they're groovy and they do a lot of, their goal is to eliminate resumes and CVs from the hiring process. Well, because they're stupid, right? Like
they are. They're absolutely retarded. And even worse is CV, because again, there was a job I fancied doing, and it was a direct. So not only did they want a CV, they wanted a cover letter and then to fill in an application form as well. And I was just like, you know what? By the time I got halfway through, I was like, no, it's just.
I don't want this job that bad.
Yeah, I don't want this job.
Yeah, I love, at least in the US market, and my colleagues in the UK tell me it's similar over there. There are candidates that are just saying no. So there are employers that are like, well, now you've been through these four rounds of interviews. Now I want you to go and create like this huge presentation and come back to me. And candidates are like, that's just doing work for you for free. And screw you.
Yeah,
I'm out. And they're just saying no. And so for the first time, like candidate in my professional career, candidates are increasingly self-empowering and just not putting up with bad behavior or bullshit from employers. Now, I still have hiring managers who say shit like, well, if they really want to work for us, they'll do blah. And as soon as I hear those words, I'm like, oh, friend, did you think you were that special? What's happening right now? Did you think you were some kind of a rare snowflake that everybody was lining up to work for you? Because they're not. So check yourself. And I have been saying things like that for a long time, but they were right, that people were willing to put up with it because they needed a job. And now they're just not. I think people have this attitude. It's like, I lived for a year through COVID with no work. Like, what are you going to do? What is there? What's left? And so I think that things are slowly changing, but I really think that ultimately employers have to be the ones that make the change, that candidates are already speaking out loudly about what they don't like, what they don't want. And it's the employers that aren't listening to that, that aren't changing their candidate experience, that are the problem. And the ones that will eventually be the dinosaurs and all this. So maybe that's your case to HR for why they should look at other things. Let's not be dinosaurs.
Let's not. One question I always ask any new candidate that start, how did you find the recruitment process? Because I'm always interested in that, especially when we have technical tests and things like that.
But obviously, hiring manager asking them that, they're not going to be like, I think y'all are a bunch of dicks.
You should say that. That's pretty much been the feedback once. It was literally just coming into COVID, mix up communication. No one really contacted them after the overletting, before they started. They went, I didn't even think I had a job. This was just bullshit. No one told me. I was feeling totally insecure. Didn't feel I could chase it up. So again, some people do, some people don't. But I normally try and engender an honest response, and you know, I think I've got that sometimes, but yes, point well made.
Further evidence that you, my friend, are one of the good ones.
I try.
So on that, I am going to honor your time and say thank you so much for joining me today. It was a real and very genuine pleasure. We, for full disclosure, Mark and I are good friends. He's godfather to one of my kids, and we've known each other for a really long time, and we very rarely get to have these kind of discussions. So thank you. I really
appreciate it. Thank you for your time. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you. You've been listening to, hey,
and what your job. For more information on how you can get your own awesome job, visit ONH Consulting at www.onhconsulting.com. We offer incredible resumes, no-nonsense career advice, and real-world tips for landing a job in today's market. Check us out on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Insta for more insider information. Soon, you'll be hearing us say, I'm Michelle Olivier, and hey, I want your job.